and welcome to the Partners in Fincrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name is Evan McGugan and I'm a senior manager in the Fincrime team here.
I'm Chris Vaughan and I'm a manager in the financial crime team.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space. In this episode, we cover country risk assessments, including recent updates from FATF, the Corruption Perception Index, and the Basel AML Index. We also talk about AMLA and finish off with some crypto enforcement action in Leeds.
Hey, Chris, how's it going?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Thanks. Not too bad at all. Congratulations, first off, I guess, on your recent promotion to manager. Must be very excited about that. A bit of positive news and a bit of validation for a lot of the good work that's been done over the past 12 months, right?
Very, very, thank you very much. And yeah, very, very happy to have been promoted. Yeah, it's great. It's, you know, as you know, I've been in consultancy for just over a year now. And yeah, it's great to see, I suppose, hard work pay off, let's say. No, it's brilliant. I'm super happy and looking forward to you know, keeping the momentum going, I suppose. So yeah, how's things with yourself?
Yeah, very well, thanks. It was my 30th birthday a few weeks ago. So that was obviously very exciting, feeling like an old man. But I guess that is life, isn't it?
It is. Congratulations. And I'm older than you, so don't be talking about the old too much.
The joys. So we've got a few topics for discussion in this podcast, I guess. Possibly key to some of the rumblings on LinkedIn and out in the world recently has been Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index and the updates that have went into that as well. So I thought we could maybe use that as a jumping off point for discussion. I think there's been some other big-ish stories that have hit the media over the past wee bit, and that would be some talk about AMLA, the EU's anti-money laundering authority, which is expected to come in this year, and then a convergence of your two true loves, crypto and Leeds, which we'll touch on at potentially the end of the podcast. But to kick things off, first off, on Transparency International and their CPI, I know that we've certainly talked about risk assessments in previous podcasts. I think broadly we've focused on whole firm rather than maybe customer or client risk assessments. I know we've touched on Schedule 3ZA of the MLRs and the EU high risk list and everything that entails as being almost overridingly important sources. So, you know, firms need to ensure that they're captured in an underlying risk assessment, in the underlying country risk assessment too, that underpins a customer risk assessment, ensuring that EDD is applied when dealing with clients involved in those countries and so on. But so too are there multiple important sources that you need to keep an eye on, and the Transparency International CPI is a really important one, or at least a very interesting one to keep an eye on when it's updated. It got updated at the end of January 2023, and the broad strokes of it is, well, it's a Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index, right? So it's all about perceived corruption in different jurisdictions across the world. They look at about 180 countries and basically grade them from 0 to 100, 100 being perceived to be very clean and 0 being perceived to be highly corrupt. I'll probably go into a bit of detail here on some of the key themes, the key changes that have come out of it. And then I think maybe it might be a good jumping off point again for us to discuss maybe what goes into a good country risk assessment and how that then ties into a good client risk assessment, and maybe what firms should be doing when it comes to these things. So key themes that have come out of it, I've written these down, and apologies, this is going to veer very, very much into me spouting a few numbers and rankings. So I probably will sound like your man at the end of the match of the day who goes and tells the scores. But Denmark, looks as though they top the list again. They got a score of 90 out of 100, which is good. They're followed by Finland, New Zealand and Norway. Bottom of the list with a score of 12 out of 100 is Somalia, followed by Syria, South Sudan and Venezuela. Interesting for us, obviously UK-based, the UK got a score of 73. They've been ranked to be the 18th least corrupt country per the CPI. they've went down 5 points since last year. They got 78 in last year's version, where they were the 11th least corrupt country. And in Ireland, they got scored 77 out of 100. They're the 10th least corrupt country in the list. They've actually improved by 4 points and four places, and actually has overtaken the UK now with respect to perceived corruption. So that's the broad strokes anyway. The executive summary, the report is quite interesting too. And it seems like the trend isn't necessarily positive. They, for the past 10 years, have been talking about the average score of the 180 countries being 43 out of 100. And they point out that that hasn't actually changed in the past 10 years, sort of indicating there's been no real global thematic progress. They also say that 26 countries have fallen to their lowest ever score. The UK actually hasn't been this low in the past decade. And 155 out of 180 countries have made no significant progress, quote unquote, against corruption, or indeed have declined since 2012. Broadly speaking, that doesn't sound very positive. But what do firms need to do with respect to this type of thing? How can firms use the likes of the CPI to conduct adequate risk assessment, country risk assessment? Chris, do you have any thoughts on the utility of the CPI? What you think it looks to achieve, or what it looks to delineate, what its pros and cons are, and then maybe how firms can apply that, as well as, you know, what should go into a good customer country risk assessment, and maybe what should firms do with respect to this recent change in the CPI?
Yeah, 100%. I think that's a good overview and gives us, you know, a bit of context with the updates there. I think the other thing to bear in mind there as well is that while the CPI has recently been updated, there's been another big change to the Basel AML index, which was recently updated as well. And I believe that one was towards the end of last year. But that's two really big sources of information that a lot of firms will be using to support their country assessments that have just recently published new scores. So, you know, yes, CPI is a big one. Basel AML index is also a big one, and firms should be looking to make sure that they have the most recently published scores of both of those. I think from my perspective, when it comes to country risk assessment, we should probably start with what the requirement is. And that would be really, in terms of the UK, and I'll focus on the UK to start with, usually the requirement would be with Regulation 18. So Regulation 18 is the whole firm risk assessment regulation, but within that you are required to consider the risk of countries as well, and jurisdictions. So that's usually, let's say, the regulatory foundation for a country risk assessment. And then I suppose we can go back and forth on this a bit, Evan, I suppose, but perhaps my initial thoughts, the first step is, and I think actually, funnily enough, very often one that people get wrong and compliance teams get wrong, I find sometimes, because it just seems too basic, is what is a country? So it sounds a very strange thing to actually start with. But if you're going to be conducting an assessment, you need to determine the jurisdictions that are going to fall privy to that assessment. And you know, there are many different, let's say, legal entities or parts of jurisdictions that you might consider the same or not the same. And you really should be making an informed decision when doing that. So, for example, I'm just throwing an example out there off the top of my head. Do you consider the Vatican to be a jurisdiction in its own right, or do you just consider it as part of Italy? Does it have any different potential risk factors that would need to be considered there? And I think one really good way of going about risk assessments from a jurisdictional perspective to start with is to use the international standard, which is ISO 3166, to get down to brass tacks. Boring, but there you go. And the ISO is actually a really good place to start, because it gives you the internationally recognized sovereign states that then you can say, okay, these are what we might encounter, these are the jurisdictions we're going to look at. From there, you know, you do need to be informed by different sources. The regulatory one that we've talked about, that you mentioned there, Evan, is Schedule 3ZA of the regulations. You need to be aware of that because of EDD measures that will need to be applied there. But, you know, there are plenty of other sources of information, like your CPI, like your Basel index, that would come into a good assessment. A lot of firms do sort of look to, let's say, aggregator scores as well. There are many sites online, places like Know Your Country, which you'll find is used very often, which actually do their own assessment, taking into account multiple different factors, such as the CPI and the Basel Index, et cetera, and will form their own scores that firms can then lean on. But I think from my perspective, it is good to have set out your own assessment and understand why you're making those decisions rather than letting a third party do that for you. So yeah, that would be my sort of my thoughts on the initial steps. Evan, what does that sound like to you? Sound like a recipe for a good assessment or no?
Yeah, I think starting with the ISO list is a great shout, actually. It sort of removes any potential for confusion to sort of start on that standardized list and then go through all the sources that you'd expect to go through to come up with an underpinning country risk matrix, almost, that takes into account all those sources that you need to then determine some sort of low, medium, high, ultra high, prohibited sort of level for each one of them. Understand the risks too, or the pros and cons rather of each source. So you mentioned the Basel AML index, and that's totally different to the CPI, right? Like the CPI is perceived corruption and the perception of like public sector corruption. So what's the likelihood and the controls to stop abuse of public position and public money and procurement and so on in all these jurisdictions. So perceived corruption is one thing. Basel AML index is going to be looking at deficiencies and national AML frameworks and whatnot. So two very different things that give you very different and very useful avenues to go down. As I say, look at the likes of 3ZA, look at the likes of EU high risk list if that's relevant. Go and have a look at the FATF lists as well, the grey list, the blacklist, EU tax blacklist as well is always a really good one. Presence of sanctions, use all that, bring that all together, document the sources you've used, ensure that risk assessment is multi-source, document why you've used those sources, what the pros and cons of each one is, and basically just keep that updated as and when anything changes. That's step one. On the topic of using a multi-source approach to customer risk assessment and country risk assessment, we talked about the different lists that you need to be checking for. Obviously, we talked about the changes to CPI, but so too are the FATF lists that you really need to be keeping an eye on to really have a holistic and well-defined approach to country risk assessment. Now, the FATF plenary actually met between the 22nd and 24th of February, and there's been some pretty sizable changes to come out of that. One, Russia has been suspended. Their membership of FATF has been suspended following on from the ongoing military invasion of Ukraine. But so too, there's been some changes to the FATF grey list, i.e. The list of jurisdictions under increased monitoring. Two countries have been added and two countries have been removed. Chris, we talked around multi-source lists and what firms need to do with respect to these. Would you like to tell us more about the countries which have been added to the FATF grey list, so to speak?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, with the changes, the two countries that have been added are South Africa and Nigeria. So that's two additional African nations that have been added to this list. And that's perhaps a bit of a trend that we're seeing there in terms of changes to the FATF list as well, with Mozambique and Tanzania both being added fairly shortly previous to this update. So there is quite a trend here of FATF targeting African nations with strategic deficiencies. So I think that's an interesting one, and it means that firms are going to have to start looking at how they may be exposed to these. You and I, Evan, are never going to be advocating for tick box compliance, but nonetheless, you do have to think of your obligations when it comes to enhanced due diligence. As of yet, at the time of recording right now, HM Treasury have not released a statement on this as in a potential update to Schedule 3ZA, but as we know, and as HM Treasury have already stated, that will come. And so we will be expecting an update to Schedule 3ZA shortly to reflect that. Evan, there's also been some changes, a couple of nations coming off that list. Do you want to cover those?
Absolutely, Chris. So the two jurisdictions that are no longer under increased monitoring are Morocco and Cambodia. The FATF noted basically that both countries had made progress in improving their national MLCTF regimes. That would have been on the basis of the action plan that the governments of those two countries would have agreed with the FATF, i.e. the manner in which they would have been looking to remediate the technical deficiencies that the FATF would have identified in their most recent assessment of those countries. So again, in the same sort of way that firms should update their lists when countries are added to the FATF grey lists, so too should firms be looking to update their lists when countries are removed from increased monitoring. I very consciously say updates because I think it's important to keep in mind that just because countries are no longer on the grey list, it doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't still be treating them as fairly high risk. For example, they may have addressed some technical deficiencies with respect to the commitments they made to the FATF, but they're still going to be under some level of monitoring and work with the FATF-style regional bodies that are located there. So again, as you say, it's not all about tick box compliance, but you know, firms should make sure to update their lists when it comes to South Africa and Nigeria, but also Morocco and Cambodia. Understand your exposures to these countries and how they affect the risk profile of your transactional profile and the activities that your clients are undertaking. Step two then is obviously using that as the underpinning country risk assessment and building that into your client risk assessment and thinking about the variables that will come in to that based on your product and service offering. So I'll chuck it back to you now, Chris, but what in your mind are good geographic risk factors to be looking at as part of a client risk assessment? And again, certainly appreciate it's going to vary on the basis of product and service offering. Some things won't be relevant for everybody, but which ones have you seen work well?
Yeah, that's a good point. Let me, before I answer your question, let me start by saying, yeah, and considering that as well, sort of EU high-risk third countries and let's say Schedule 3ZA / FATF jurisdictions under increased monitoring, depending on jurisdiction within the EU, there are actually differing requirements on which of those should be considered high-risk for the purposes of EDD. So, you know, you can think of Lithuania, for example, where both of those will actually matter, whereas from the UK perspective, it's only the Schedule 3ZA, which reflects the FATF countries that would need to be considered. So that is definitely a nuance to be aware of as well. But, you know, going back to your original question, which was what factors we can consider, there are obviously, you know, a large number. The obvious one to begin with is country of incorporation if you're servicing legal entities, where the legal entity that is your customer is incorporated. But you do also need to take into account countries of operation as well, where they may be different. Not all legal entities are operating in the jurisdiction in which they're incorporated. Location of UBOs might be something you could consider, where they're set up. You could, in cases of retail customers, you could consider things like nationality. That sometimes plays a risk factor. It might not be, you know, the be all and end all, but nonetheless, it should be considered. Location of your client for a retail client as well should be considered. Yeah, all of these. I think another one that is perhaps not a traditional one, but is nonetheless more and more a factor that can be taken into account is IP location, something that, for example, if you have a kind of an eKYC process, very standard sort of ID and V, you want to ensure that the account is being accessed from the place in which you expect it to be by the customer that you feel that you should have identified and verified, that the person you think you're doing business with is actually accessing that account. And on an ongoing basis, that can be monitored as well. That there's an argument to be made that that's more of a fraud outlook, but I think it's actually relevant for AML purposes as well, particularly where transactions are being conducted in countries other than the one that you think your customer is based in. Yeah, what does that sound like? That I think those are all good ones to be aware of. Any more of them?
No, I think that's all the main ones, right? Make sure that that's all adequately sort of backed up with that underpinning risk assessment. Make sure, to your point on nationality, and that can sometimes be a bit of a weird one, assessing somebody on the basis of where they were born rather than where they currently live, reside, or do business. And I know we've went in and done audits, and people have seen that as an overriding risk factor. Like, if you are a Russian who was, you know, born in Russia at the age of four and hasn't lived there since and has no connections to the country now, or the perceived risk by Russia on a country level, that's been disproportionately weighted, leading to EDD and high risk statuses for Russian nationals. Steer away from that if it's not actually going to reduce risk or lead to the application of due diligence or controls which are actually going to mitigate something. But yeah, to that point, like, weighting, make sure everything's adequately weighted, and document the manner in which it's all weighted in a methodology. Do that testing to ensure that, again, country risk, it's all ultimately in a sense based on perception, right? So just make sure it all actually gives you the answer at the end of the day that you need to be going for. And then I guess outside of risk assessment at the point of onboarding, or maybe on an ongoing basis, when you think about periodic event-driven reviews, think about how this ties into the rest of your control framework as well. So we talked about CPI to kick this off. It's changed. To be honest, it hasn't changed hugely since last year. I had a look at the report earlier today, and they have a wee section that talks about statistically significant changes, and there hasn't really been any. There's been like two, and it's drops from like 79 to 74 and so on. So probably not a huge amount's going to have to change for most firms with respect to CPI. But if somebody was to see a change in 3ZA, or somebody was, you know, a country was to become greylisted or blacklisted or whatever the case may be, then that's much more of a trigger. So think about how these things, once implemented in your control framework, can potentially change on an ongoing basis. Be that your TM, making sure that your TM is tied into all this, making sure that the country risk methodology for TM alerts for high risk country rules is all tied in and updated on an ongoing basis. Even like where you're placing reliance on firms too, like other financial institutions. What if a financial sector gets a really bad, FATF review, money val goes in and, you know, dings Malta for strategic deficiencies? How does that then affect you placing reliance on a Maltese EMI and that type of stuff? So there's a lot to think about, a lot to go on. And yeah, it's really, you just need to keep it monitored and updated really on an ongoing basis, don't you?
Yeah, agreed. That's it. It's the, at least, because there's not necessarily a right answer to how you handle the changing jurisdictional risk on an ongoing basis. There's not going to be a source of information that tells you need to immediately go and remediate a customer account if it's exposed to a country that changes its risk level, but you should at least be aware of it from a second line perspective and have a policy around how you are going to handle that situation. Periodic review, as you've said there, will cover you for the most part, but there might be more stringent measures that you may need to take. Maybe you need to do an immediate review. At least you need to have a reason for the decision that you're taking, rather than sort of just letting it go unawares, I suppose. You know, at least have that oversight, ensure that you're aware of the approach and how you're going to tackle it, and any remediation efforts that might need to be made. I think as well, risk appetite, you review your risk appetite as well, ensure that still sits, within the risk appetite for the firm. If it is evolving, and if your already onboarded customer base is changing in risk level, then that should affect it, and you should be aware, and that can affect things as well. I think that hopefully gives a decent overview, and as we say, there's been some recent changes, so maybe firms can have another think about looking back over their country risk assessment, just making sure that it still is up to scratch.
Spot on. And we managed to avoid any political discussion about how the UK has become less corrupt over the past year. So well done us.
Yeah, indeed.
Grant, moving on then to AMLA or AMLA. I've listened to some interviews and I'm reliably informed it's going to be pronounced AMLA. So make of that what you will. But yeah, it's the EU's proposed or soon to come in anti-money laundering authority. I think it was, well, we're 2023 now, aren't we? It was sort of officialized almost in 2021, and I think it is due to really sort of come in properly to some extent this year. Some legislative processes still needing to be undertaken, and from my most recent reading, it seems like January the 1st now, 2024, it's going to be like properly operational in some regard. and then sort of fully and wholly operational from 2026. If you sort of search for AMLA on LinkedIn, you'll see like member states and cities are still bidding for hosting it. So like Frankfurt and Madrid and Vienna and whatnot, all bidding to host AMLA, funded from the EU budget, initially looking to have like 100 employees and then getting to 250 or so once they're alive and kicking. I think on the basis that it's coming, a lot of it's probably still up in the air at the moment. But I mean, think about all the money laundering scandals and laundromats that we've seen over the years, like Danske Bank, Swedbank, ING, all EU financial institutions. The list goes on. So like, what do we think, Chris? Like one single independent authority to keep an eye on AML and financial crime compliance across the EU seems like it could probably only be a good thing.
Yeah, I think from our perspective, it probably does sound like a good thing. Obviously, as things get put into practice, it'll become more material and we'll be able to sort of see how it develops. But I think the idea of unifying the approach across the EU, or at least trying to harmonise to some degree, is a good one. So EU level harmonisation in terms of regulation and supervision, and then also perhaps increasing collaboration for FIUs as well from an EU perspective. I don't know how this will work, but in terms of how the AMLA will sit with the Egmont group and whether there'll be some sort of interaction there as well, difficult to say at this point and probably far too early days. But nonetheless, I do think it is good that there will be an EU level approach that will be sort of a single source of truth from an AML perspective, maybe, and we'll bring some harmonisation across the states. So yeah, I do think a good thing. Any thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, agreed. I think anything that involves sort of easier coordination of FIU activity, number one, to your point, is hopefully going to be a good thing if they do link in with Egmont, which seems like it would be the easier way to do that. Then that would be fantastic. More intelligence sharing across member states. Harmonization, as you say, of supervisory practices, if it shakes out effectively, would be great. Like, I think there is still the potential for a certain degree of regulatory arbitrage across the EU27, and we've seen, well, the EU taking action against member states for not having implemented some aspects of previous MLDs beyond a time frame which you think was reasonable. So that will all be good, hopefully. And then I know there's also talk of direct supervision by AMLA of certain high risk or cross-border FIs as well, which would be a pretty interesting step change in the supervision of high risk and large corporates. Again, remains to be seen what that's going to look like. Are they going to take a lead on VASP supervision? I know that's been sort of mooted as a potential. And how that then feeds into MiCA and everything else. And does AMLA take, a big lead on that? Potentially could be a pretty positive development. Don't know if you have any thoughts on how that could, improve the crypto supervision aspect or if there's any other things that you think on that. But yeah, I mean, that could be, again, it's all up in the air, but it's going to be very interesting to see how it moves. And I expect in 6 months' time, we'll all sort of know.
Yeah, I think, like you say, it's too early days to say, but I think there certainly is that we've seen different jurisdictions across the EU take all sorts of different approaches when it comes to crypto. So perhaps it would be good to have a unified approach. And again, too early to say, but perhaps AMLA will provide that and be more of a framework for some of the grey areas and be able to provide that guidance. But I suppose we'll see. Speaking of crypto, though, there is one final topic which I'd like to finish off for the day. Unless you have anything further on that.
No, and I'll let you take a lead on this one.
Yeah. So the reason that this one's close to my heart is because my three great loves have clashed. That being anti-money laundering, first of all, of course, cryptocurrency, second, and my hometown of Leeds. So this was some recent news from the FCA, which came out, and it was, I think, a press release from the FCA, but then it was covered in all sorts of different areas because it's quite an interesting story, actually. I'm not just throwing this in as a token effort for the purposes of being from Leeds. But the FC actually combined with local law enforcement in West Yorkshire to tackle unlicensed ATMs, crypto ATMs, that apparently had been identified in the area. And this is quite an interesting one. Around the time of the sort of the regulatory permissions window that the FCA opened up for VASPs, it was commented when all of that sort of finished that none of the firms that had been licensed to operate as VASPs in the UK had actually registered a crypto ATM. So therefore, there are no legal crypto ATMs in the UK at all. So it's an interesting one to see the enforcement actually happen from the FCA sort of live. And obviously Leeds is the first place that this seems to have happened, where they've been targeting these unlicensed ATMs. What is a crypto ATM, you might ask? I think for the most part, it's generally just places where you can deposit cash and purchase cryptocurrency. How does that work? Like an ATM that you would normally have, but funds are sent to a cryptocurrency address through the machine. And the FCA has not authorised any of these for operation in the UK to this point, and they obviously come and fall under the scope of the VASP regime, so they would need to be registered. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think, does it mean anything for firms? I think firms should be aware that there are no regulated ATMs in the UK, no legal ones. Crypto ATMs is something that you can monitor for on the blockchain using various blockchain analytics providers that crypto firms use. And yeah, it's a risk indicator to be aware of. I think it's great that there's sort of enforcement action around that. You know, that's just an interesting point, and I wanted to sort of bring that up. So yeah, I don't know if you've got any thoughts around that, Evan, but I think it'd be a nice little story just to finish off on crypto in my hometown.
Yeah, agreed. And I must confess, I wasn't aware that there was no registered ATMs in the UK. And I know certainly I've walked past a couple. So yeah, I mean, if you come across any prospective clients offering that service, you may want to take a look at them. You mentioned earlier about how the Vatican may present a different risk profile to Italy as a component part almost, but also a separate country. And I don't know, is this a trigger for everybody to think about Leeds and the specific risk profile of Leeds? I think it should probably be high risk anyway, right?
Depends. High risk for terrible football.
No, nothing else for me on that question, on that story. But yeah, pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is interesting stuff. Perfect. Look, Evan, I think we've had our fill for today. A few good stories there, things for people to be thinking about and having eyes on. Any final comments or thoughts?
Nope, that's pretty much everything from me, Chris.
Perfect. So thanks everyone for tuning in again, and yeah, take care and have a good one.
Nice one. All the best.